You're listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast with your hosts, Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. I'm Bobby McMahon, and joining me is Owen O'Callaghan, and the controls we have producer Luke Crawford. This week on the podcast, we look back on a week that saw Chelsea fight back to beat Manchester United in the Premier League, Everton go out the FA Cup Championship side Reading. We look forward to Liverpool against Manchester United on Sunday at Anfield in the second legs of four Champions League round of 16 matches. First off though, Everton. What'd you make of them, Owen? They beat Chelsea in a replay, go down to penalty kicks, win it in quite magnificent fashion for Everton, knock Chelsea out, and then they go out to Reading. What'd you make of them?
I think Everton's season can be summed up by that image of David Moyes on the touchline, just kind of staring blankly into space as his team once again hints at just this ridiculous inconsistency. I'm not sure if David Moyes picks his side on a Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, whatever it is, and just does not know what level of performance those 11 players will go out and produce for him. Because in the Reading case, you go from that high of the Chelsea game, you ought to go and look at a cup run. And, you know, for teams who are struggling in the league, to be in the kind of the business end of a tournament like a cup, that's a great positive to have. It's a lovely thing to almost rely on to, you know, if you're struggling in the season, to have it in your, you know, in your arsenal almost to look back on as, well, you know, maybe we had a bit of a difficult league spell, but at least we had a decent cup run to look back on in a positive light. But now, defeat to Reading, they were booed off in that Reading game as well. And once again, you look at their injury worries. You look at Fellaini's out for the rest of the season. You look at Cahill and Saha, who just consistently struggle with fitness problems all the time. And I just look at David Moyes now, and you're really at that fork in the road regarding his career, aren't you? I mean, he's been at Everton a long time, and he's brought them glorious days in the sunshine. But he's also quite recently had to put up with this just relentless inconsistency, mixed form, decent performance followed usually by two poor performances. And I just think it's time for him to think long and hard about where he sees himself in 5 years, pretty much.
You look at the loss to Reading after the win against Chelsea, and it almost, to me, seems to be it's a microcosm of Everton under David Moyes for the last few years. Everton have played their best stuff when they've been the underdogs.
Yeah.
When they've had their backs to the wall, when they've had injuries, playing without strikers and having to make do and moving players around. You put them up against a good team in these circumstances and they usually put in a good performance. But then you put them against more substandard opposition and that's where they seem to fall. I look at the game against Sunderland on the weekend. Arteta looked like he was coming back into form. He's really, the injuries he had at the beginning of the season has not helped Everton. And he's been a bit off the pace. He looked like he was coming good again. And then they go out the cup when it seems to be, especially Manchester City, they've got potentially City coming up in the next round at that point. Now, it would have been City because they beat Aston Villa 3-0. But you look at a team like City, and Everton have got such a good record against City.
Yeah.
Everyone seemed to be kind of lining up for Everton to make another run at potentially a place in Wembley, and it all goes. Do you see what options does Moyes have? Is he a top four manager? Do you see if somebody, if say Ancelotti disappeared, do you really think Chelsea would give Moyes a shot at taking the team on?
It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one to imagine. As in, perhaps Moyes is one of those managers, one of those coaches who gets off on looking at players, identifying players, and getting the most out of limited players. And, you know, in saying that, getting most out of a limited team, limited budget, limited resources, and, you know, almost looked upon as being that under the radar terrific manager.
So you're saying he's a limited manager?
I would find it hard to imagine him. You've come in for speculation in the last few years, linking him with a United job. I could not see him as a United manager.
I think the one great drawback he's got, and I think the bigger clubs would use this against him if they were considering him, is just a lack of real solid European experience.
Yeah.
Like, they've been in Europe, but as far as the Champions League is concerned, when they did get the Champions League, what was that, maybe 5 years ago, they went out to Villarreal in the qualifying round. And so any experience has been Europa League. And although they have had some good performances, did have some good performances in Europa League, essentially, I don't think that really sort of lines up to the quality we see in the Champions League. I think that's a big knock against him. And I just wonder if he's not the kind of guy that'd be better going overseas.
Do you think he'd succeed overseas?
I don't know. I think sometimes we think maybe in terms of being a stereotypical kind of Scotsman, but you know, if he's ever going to get the big chance, I think he's going to have to find it taking another route, because I just don't think that straight ahead route is going to get him there. But you know, whether he does a Bobby Robson, goes to kind of Portugal,
exactly,
or something like that, you just wonder if he's not getting to the stage where it must be pretty depressing to some extent, year after year, knowing that you've got limited resources and you've got to squeeze everything out of the team, and then what's the best you're going to get? A Europa League spot? And maybe a run at Wembley at the semi-final?
Yeah, and as well, I mean, you're dealing with January transfer window comes along, and you don't have money. You have to sell to spend, you know, and then you look at if he is being considered for any sort of major job, the pressure of the pot of money that exists there, whether or not you can use that money to the club's benefit. How many ropey signings are you going to bring in, basically because you don't have big enough experience in bringing players to a club with a big price tag and you know, getting the best out of those players and dealing with them being underperforming and having to maybe leave them out, sit on the bench for a few games, bring them back in. You know, all those little nuances that I suppose the biggest managers out there currently have had to experience. Does Moyes have enough, I suppose, of the rounded managerial experience to make him, an object of desire for the bigger clubs?
Well, I think you bring up a good point there, one about the kind of players they bring in. And I think if you look at Manchester United, you look at Chelsea, you look at Arsenal, to some extent City as well, and maybe even Tottenham, I think what you're seeing is the difference between the top five teams and the rest of the teams. Now, Liverpool may push back into that, may become a top six.
Yeah.
But I think the difference you've got is that these teams have one, two, three, sometimes four players that you look at and say, these are top-class players. Well, Everton have got good players, but when he signs more players, does he really upgrade the team, or does he just strengthen the depth of the squad? Like, he's not adding that 25 million or that 20 million, million pound player.
Yeah.
Arsenal, you look at, is different. They're producing their own players to some extent, but they still go out into the market. And Wenger, he's careful shopping, etc., etc. But I just wonder if Everton's situation, that they just are in a reality at the moment, in the foreseeable future, they just can't really get any better. Maybe more points, but really, are they ever going to be regarded as a top four team in the next 3 or 4 years? I'm not sure.
And
I don't think so.
And as well, I think the problem that surely eats away at you as a coach, as a manager, is when you do identify that you've got particularly these young players at your club who are the future of the club, can't be the future of the club because they are such valuable assets that in 2-3 years' time, you lose them. Yeah. The likes of Jack Rodwell, the likes of Seamus Coleman even, they will be gone. And that's just a reality check for Everton fans. And so even at a grassroots level, you bring these players through the ranks, even though Coleman was brought from Sligo in the League of Ireland, you bring them through the ranks, you mould them, and you place them in circumstance where their development will almost become faster because they're given first team opportunities,
given a chance to play.
At a quicker rate, and then subsequently you lose them in their prime and in their pomp. And I think it's a harsh reality for Everton, and I suppose I'd be interested to hear a take from a few Everton supporters on how they really feel about where their club is going.
So, Owen, on to Manchester United and Chelsea. Game of two halves?
It was, and Chelsea now, apparently, are back in the title race.
According to Frank Lampard.
According to Frank Lampard, which is always nice to hear. Nothing like a bit of competition. But yes, getting back to the game, it was a game of two halves. United started very well. And I think, it's worth remembering how poor United's record at Stamford Bridge has been. I think
going into it was eight games before. since they'd last won.
Yeah, and now it's like, I think it's, yeah, you know, six defeats from their last nine.
Chelsea for years have had a little bit of a hex on United, haven't they?
I always think back to even in the mid-90s when United were, you know, very, very difficult to beat. But Chelsea always seemed to...
Go Old Trafford, come away with a 3-0 win.
Gavin Peacock.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 93-94, they had successive wins home and away, and Gavin Peacock was the man who scored both goals in both those games. Whatever happened to Gavin Peacock? He's a priest now.
I think he's in Calgary.
Really?
I'm pretty sure the last thing I heard, now this is a bit out of date, this might go back maybe 15, 18 months,
yeah,
but I believe he'd moved out to Calgary and he was doing his training at in Calgary.
For the priesthood?
Yeah.
Incredible. Now, producer Luke, let's get Gavin Peacock on the show next week. I'd like to hear his memories about scoring.
As long as we're not taping on a Sunday.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have to pause for the Sabbath and all that. Anyway, getting back to Chelsea against Manchester United. Wayne Rooney gets them going. Interesting lineup for United. They obviously decided Scholes and Carrick. Whenever you see Scholes and Carrick in the middle of the park, you know Ferguson's worried about keeping the ball. It's the only reason those two are paired together. He obviously had Fletcher wide right in order to snuff out that threat from Ashley Cole at left back, and Nani moved to the left side.
You notice we got through an Ashley Cole reference without a cheap gag. I think that was well done.
I was away in Toronto for a few days, and a few days kind of break from my very stressful life that I have. And I didn't bring my laptop, was completely removed from everything football related, and went down to the business centre.
That's why you're in Toronto.
Exactly. Just went into the business centre, logged on. You know, it's like $15 for 2 minutes. So I
use it well.
So I went on to bbc.co.uk/sport and found out that Ashley Cole had shot somebody, Wayne Rooney had elbowed somebody, and Birmingham won the Carling Cup final. So it was.
Which was the biggest shock?
Probably Ashley Cole. I was like, wow, actually shot someone. That, you know, target practice, you're improving all the time. Normally, it kind of skews wide of the far post. Anyway, we're getting off the beaten track here.
No penalty references.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, Manchester United in the second half. And there wasn't really kind of a turning point. There wasn't, you know, Chelsea didn't make a change to their formation. They didn't really alter their tactics that much. But obviously, Chelsea came out and they equalised through David Luiz, who, in many reports, people wax lyrical about his performance. And in many cases, he was an obvious man of the match choice. But there was another element to David Luiz's game, which has come in for criticism, and that is his physicality. Clearly, he should have not remained on the pitch. He was booked. He had an incident with Chicharito before he got booked. And then obviously there was that clothesline on Wayne Rooney later on, which was a clear second bookable offence. I'm not sure how the referee missed it. But as people have talked about, karma is a bitch.
Bit of karma.
Exactly. Mr. Rooney, I don't think, has a lot to complain about. Luiz took his goal incredibly well.
Brilliantly.
Yeah.
Like I was away as well, so I didn't see the game live, but yeah. I managed to hook up with the internet on late, just after the game was finished, and mm-hmm. the goals were up on a couple of websites quite quickly.
Yeah,
and quite frankly, the Luiz finish was stunning.
Mm.
I don't know. There's any other centre half in the world could have scored that goal on purpose.
Michael Dawson, perhaps.
Yeah, no.
I get it.
No Efinokuku references. The best passer of the ball, the best centre half passer of the ball in the league, apparently. But I don't think there'd be many strikers that could take that goal. That was a stunning finish.
The one thing that I looked at on that goal was from the wide angle on the replay. Patrice Evra's positioning, I think, could be brought into question a little bit.
United, so it was a big question mark. I mean, great going forward. But you pay a price.
And it was, firstly, Ivanovic winning that ball in the air, yeah, beating his compatriot Vidic in the air to flick it on. And the ball takes a bounce off the turf. And on the replay, and I know it's always hindsight is 20/20, right? But I just would have felt Evra would have gone in with his head. Because I think if you're going with your head, granted there's going to be a bit of a collision, but you're guaranteed, firstly, that you clear the ball first, but also you get a free kick.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're braver, you know, Luiz is going to, you know, catch you around the chest area. And you're going to get a free out from the referee. It's going to be an easy free kick, and the pressure is going to die down. Instead, Evra tried to kind of go toe for toe with Luiz, came out on the wrong side of it, and finished, just fizzes past Van der Sar at his near post. Van der Sar just rooted to the spot, couldn't do anything about it. The penalty, that wins Chelsea the game. This, again, came in for a little bit of a spotlight. Alex Ferguson, after his, after the game, absolutely livid with this decision, claimed that Smalling got the ball. Obviously, he was watching a different replay to me.
Yeah.
It was an innocuous challenge, not a lot of malice in it, but I think we both feel that, that it was a definite spotter.
Yeah, Smalling got really... Now, the ball's pinging around there, but he gets done with the ball through his legs, and Zhirkov goes looking for a leg, perhaps, but I think it's a penalty. I think I sense with Ferguson's rant after that game, it was another distraction from... One, it was a distraction from the performance, and I wonder if it's the opening salvo in a let's get the wagons in a circle, boys. They all hate us, and they're all out to screw us and trying to really squeeze a little bit more out of this Manchester United team. I kind of sensed it. It's maybe a little bit of... Not usual for Ferguson, and it's difficult to interpret the difference of fear in Ferguson with combativeness, but maybe there's a little bit of doubt in his mind. You go back to the Marseille game, how he's approached some games.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of doubt in Ferguson's mind that this team isn't as good as he's perhaps made it out to be.
Well, I just think once again, we talked about this in our Champions League analysis post-Marseille game. You're looking to change a game and you're looking to look for something else, a bit of a cutting edge. You bring on Ryan Giggs from the bench. Yeah. I mean, he did that against Marseille. He brought Scholes on. But you're looking at Ryan Giggs to come in. He brought him in centrally. He wasn't as if he was brought on wide, almost a stretch. Not that Giggs could, at his age, stretch Chelsea too much from a wide position, but he brought him on centrally. It would, in my estimation, have made more sense to put Giggs wide and bring Nani across to the right and kind of just attack Ashley Cole. But even at 1-1, Ferguson seemed to be concerned with Ashley Cole being a threat down the left side.
But to be fair to him, 1-1 would have been a pretty good result.
It would have been.
Wouldn't have been a bad result. Going to Stamford Bridge, you mentioned already the record they have at Stamford Bridge, the fact that Chelsea have caused them problems, knowing that they've got to take Chelsea back, they've got Chelsea back at Old Trafford in the last, maybe I think it's third last game of the season, the week after they go to the Emirates. But given the way the league is shaping up prior to that game, a point I don't think would have been that bad a result.
No.
You would have, you know, Arsenal would have the opportunity to perhaps cut into that lead a little bit, but I don't think a point at Stamford Bridge, no matter how badly or how well Chelsea are playing, it kind of works out.
For Carlo Ancelotti, once again, he paired two up front, and very, very quickly you're coming to realise that his first choice pairing is Nicolas Anelka and Fernando Torres.
Drogba going back to Marseille?
Drogba going back to Marseille.
If
Drogba going somewhere else,
someplace, yeah.
Surely in the summer, because he's not really a character who would... enjoy being on the bench for a long period. How did you think that? In this context of, you know, and again,
he's an odd man before. Out. He just is.
He just doesn't fit. Just,
no, not. We talked. I think it was talked about last week. If you look at the three of them, and Anelka becomes the guy that doesn't get dropped because he's the one that seems to be able to play with the other two to some extent. I've still never really been convinced that Anelka plus Drogba gives you actual more. I think you actually get a little bit less with them. But I think with Torres and the money that's been spent on Torres, Ancelotti's in a position he's got to find a way of getting somebody to work with Torres, and I think it looks very much like it's going to be Anelka. Now, Drogba plays with Torres, they score a couple of goals each. Yeah, everybody will be jumping on the bandwagon saying, yeah, they can play together. I've been very quick to say that about Drogba and Anelka, but over a period of time with a broader kind of body of work, I think you come to the conclusion that Drogba and Anelka wasn't the greatest fit, and I just don't think Drogba and Torres have the look of being a great fit either. But you did mention one name there earlier on, a couple of minutes ago, leading up to Louis' goal, and just want to touch on this very quickly. But Ivanovic, could you make a case that Ivanovic has been Chelsea's most valuable player this year?
I think he's been a great signing for them. I think, and there's always that question mark about players who come in and they start off as a fullback. And then suddenly they're branched into centre-back. And you're like, well, okay, you can't, you know, you could never see Nemanja Vidic do something similar.
Yep.
Centre-back, one position, and he dominates that position. But Ivanovic really has rarely let Chelsea down in comparison to his defensive colleagues on occasion. Most notably, even players in more of a senior role than him.
But it was interesting when he came in as well, because he was signed, I can't remember which team it was.
January, wasn't he?
He was, and he completely disappeared. There was nothing seen of him for months.
Yeah.
And whether he was unfit or whether there was some other problems, I've never read any explanation of why he wasn't given a chance. You can only interpret that as being not ready for whether it was his physical condition or whether there was something else going on. We've never really found out, but it took him a long time before he really really made an impact or got a chance to make an impact with Chelsea.
Yeah, and as well, what's interesting about Ivanovic is that he had to deal with this constant right side problem that exists at Chelsea with Paulo Ferreira there, Bossingwell there. They never seem to get it right, and then they just decide upon, well, let's try Ivanovic here.
It also goes back further than that, doesn't it? You know, some teams have problem areas they never seem to be able to resolve. And Chelsea, you go back to Glenn Johnson.
Yeah,
remember they signed Glenn Johnson at one point. Yeah. He was in there, and to be honest, I can't remember who the right back was before Glenn Johnson, but.
My mind just goes back to the glory days of Dan Petrescu, Albert Ferrer.
Petrescu pushing up in the wing back position at times as well. But so that's Chelsea making the league title chase a little bit more exciting.
Vaguely interesting, yes.
Certainly, the gap there, beginning to pull that other group back into it slightly. Still needs an awful lot of amazing things to happen before I think Chelsea, Tottenham, or Manchester City could regard themselves as having a chance. They'd need a collapse from Arsenal as well as Manchester United. United going to Liverpool this weekend. That is the marquee match of the weekend.
United going to Liverpool at the weekend, and Mr. Ferguson coming out after the game. And I think you know Ferguson is just such a master of manipulation. You know, and he comes out and puts a pressure on Martin Atkinson once again.
Yeah.
He's going to Anfield where there'll be even more added pressure. I don't know who's officiating the game.
I don't think it'd be Martin Atkinson.
I don't think it'd be Martin Atkinson, that's for sure. But again, for those decisions to come under the microscope, United, the visiting team, how much are they going to favour the home side? We're coming here as underdogs. It'll be interesting to see if there's any big calls in that Liverpool United game and how the balance, which side it favours come the end of 90 minutes. A couple of things about United's fixture list. Liverpool away, followed by Arsenal at home in the Cup, followed by Marseille at home in the Champions League. Three obviously very, very big games. But after that, and again, you're looking kind of further down the road, they've got that, you know, Arsenal-Chelsea in the last couple of games of the season to look forward to. But after those three games, you've got Bolton, West Ham and Fulham. So, I mean, if they can possibly take Liverpool at Anfield, it would set them up very nicely for that three-game stretch, Bolton, West Ham and Fulham, where you should really see them take 9 points in those games.
If they could get a draw at Anfield, would that be a good result for them?
I think it would be an okay result. I think a win would be absolutely terrific for them. I think if for a variety of reasons. Firstly, in the title chase and you're coming back after a ropey defeat, so psychologically. But also just to get them back on track. A lot of question marks about their form and their consistency and what type of Manchester United are going to be playing against you at any given moment. So I think if they go to Anfield and prove a few of their doubters wrong, it would be very interesting. But huge history problems when it comes to United visiting Anfield.
Yeah.
Let's see. 2-0 defeat last season, Vidic sent off. 2-1 defeat in 2008, Vidic sent off. So the good thing about Vidic not playing is that he doesn't make himself available.
No Ferdinand.
Wes Brown and Smalling. And if I was Kenny Dalglish, if Andy Carroll was 70% fit, I would start him in that game.
See, I think the whether United, the United result at Anfield on Sunday has to be put in the broader context of how Arsenal do against Sunderland.
Exactly.
If Arsenal can come out and get a result against Sunderland, meaning a win in this context, not a draw, they can beat Sunderland, who are on a bit of a slide at the moment. I think that's four losses they've had in a row. If Arsenal can get 3 points, then that puts a lot of pressure on United. And if United could only come away with a point, suddenly it's almost like a break of serve in there, to use a tennis analogy.
Yeah.
And things begin to move a little bit more in Arsenal's favour.
A couple of things about Liverpool. 7 goals in their last 7 games.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that defeat by West Ham has set them back a little bit. But even that West Ham game, I was just taking a look at a few bits and pieces. They obviously had Gerrard, Morelos, Suarez and Coates on the pitch. 6 shots on target. And Suarez came up against James Tompkins, I think it was, and Tompkins just played him.
And they never played any balls in the... counting the fingers on one hand, the number of high balls he played in the penalty area to a team that this year, and last year actually as well, West Ham have been absolutely pathetic in terms of defending crosses, and they really didn't test them. I think when you saw Martin Kelly going off and then Morelos going off, you just lose a couple of players out of that team, out of that starting 11, and you begin to really see how thin the Liverpool squad is. It is a thin squad.
Well, I'm interested to see what they do without Martin Kelly, because does that now mean that Glenn Johnson will go back to right back? Will they bring in, if Aurelio is fit, will he come back in at left back?
I felt they played three at the back last week again with Kelly pushing up into that wing back position with Danny Wilson playing part of that three across the back with Scotland Carragher. I think was showing some really bad signs last week. There were a couple of situations where he didn't commit himself to tackles or allowed crosses to get in. He looked like he was not. He was falling back into that kind of poor run of form he had at the beginning of last season. There were some real question marks about his application and whether he really lost a step. Now we've seen flurries of Carragher getting back to his old self, blocking shots. Carragher, I think, in his best day, was always one of the best last-ditch defenders.
Last-ditch, yeah.
But there's a difference between being a great last-ditch defender and being a great defender.
Yeah.
And I think, once again, you look at the Liverpool side, it's very thin. The squad is thin. And one of the most interesting questions, I think, in the coming summer will be how Liverpool go about trying to rejuvenate that squad.
One of the things about Carragher, you mentioned his possible lack of form as they go into this game against United on Sunday. Does that mean that Javier Hernandez will keep his place up top, and will they try to take full advantage of perhaps Carragher being a little bit slow, being a little bit rusty? Do you think that Berbatov will once again be on the bench?
I would think that's a very good question, and I think will tell you a lot about how Ferguson really feels about Berbatov. We know Berbatov scored a lot of goals this year. He's also scored a lot of goals against teams that perhaps aren't that good. And the fact that Hernandez is so sharp at the moment, and if you look at a weakness in Liverpool, it would be around the sharpness. Skrtel, I still don't think, has had a very good season. No. I think he's ever present, which probably tells you a lot about how the problems Liverpool have had this year.
Yeah.
He hasn't been good, and I think it's the kind of game that would be ideal for Hernandez. Now, maybe there's also a possibility we might actually see a three. We might actually see Rooney, Berbatov and Hernandez, with Rooney dropping a little bit deeper. That would be interesting.
Well, I think particularly if the game isn't going according to plan for Alex Ferguson. Alex Ferguson, who's made a name of bringing on guys like Ryan Giggs and Paul Scholes in recent weeks in effort to change games, perhaps we'll begin to see how much he is worried about this title chase. If, for instance, after 65-70 minutes Liverpool are in front, what does he do to change things?
Okay, here's the capper. What's the chances of finishing with 22 players on the field?
Very, very slim. I don't know when the last game was. There wasn't a sending off in the 3-2 game.
That was a Berbatov hat-trick, yes. That was one of the highlights of Berbatov's season.
But at Anfield, traditionally,
and Gerrard went off in the cup game.
Gerrard went off in the cup game. Vidic has got sent off for the last two seasons. Yeah,
Torres to worry about this time.
No, absolutely not.
Mascherano, yes, history there.
There's definitely always, particularly if someone picks up a yellow card within the first 10-15 minutes, chances are they're not going to see the remainder of the game. But it's always one of those games, particularly when you come into the business end of the season. Also, at Anfield, I think that's the big thing. That's just for some reason, United games at Old Trafford don't really live up to the spice and the intensity that games at Anfield always do. You've had games in the past that have been thrilling, full of drama, full of urgency, full of creativity, full of great moments to look back on.
And with the 6:30 or the early kickoff, 6:30 our time in Central Standard Time, and 1:30 over there, the one thing the police are trying to make sure of is the game isn't full of spectators who have got full of drink.
A little bit too merry.
Yes.
Yeah, for their own good. But it's interesting. One of the things I would say about United, though, currently, is the importance of Nani. And is there almost an over-reliance on Nani? I think it's
15 assists this
Yeah, like last week. 5 games, 2 goals and 3 assists. Yeah. So he's very consistent in doing something in a game that is overtly positive towards the full-time result. So, but because they miss Valencia on one side, there almost seems to be that let's get the ball to Nani and let's see if he can do something. But ultimately, Nani's not Ronaldo. He doesn't have that same twist and he's gone moment. He doesn't have the same kick in his heels.
Likes a bit of the power as well. Ronaldo's
exactly.
a big boy.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people forget that about Ronaldo. That's, you know, in the air, he is a really potent force. One of the drawbacks to Nani's game, you know, how many headers has he scored in his time at United? So perhaps it's something for United to worry about. That's, for instance, if they name the same team once again for the trip to Liverpool, which would be very, very interesting.
Two in a row.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, when the last time Ferguson would have done? Oh well,
of course, it's the first unchanged team in 165 games, so back to back,
and of course, three in a row. Enforced changes with Vidic being out.
That's true. Yeah,
but outside of the Vidic little conundrum that he has, I just wonder what he might do. One of the interesting things that somebody very close to Manchester United told me a number of years ago that I've never forgotten is for games like this, for Manchester derbies, games against Liverpool, games against Arsenal, you can always be sure that at least one of Giggs, Scholes, in past seasons, Neville, are on the pitch because of the intensity of the game, what it means to the club, what it means to the players. Because it's a different type of game. And history, pedigree, tradition feeds into it so much. So I think certainly you can be sure that one of Giggs or Scholes will be starting. I'd imagine it'll be Scholes paired with Carrick once again, keep that kind of central midfield. That did very well in the first half against Chelsea. Second half, obviously, it had its drawbacks.
Now we turn our attention to Champions League, round of 16. Second legs got underway this Tuesday. First off, Barcelona, down 2-1 to Arsenal. Take them back to Nou Camp. How do you see this one?
I see it very tough on Arsenal. We have talked before about memories of last year and the ghosts of Leo Messi. And I'm sure that will be preying heavily on Arsene Wenger's mind, because 2-1 taking it to Barcelona is still a very, very shaky scoreline. Barcelona will score. I think, you know, you have to get that straight. They have injury problems, though. And we saw against Valencia just recently, Sergio Busquets playing centre-back, which I'm sure he will be
playing. He's done on other occasions this
absolutely.
Year. With PK being suspended.
Yeah. No Victor Valdez yet. No Carlos Puyol back. Xavi is back for them. But very interestingly, he left Pedro out of the starting lineup for Valencia, maybe to give him a bit of a rest prior to this kind of big game that's on the horizon. Arsenal also have huge injury problems. And it's something that Arsene Wenger would have cursed, really, when he saw, firstly, the Leighton Orient replay. And just, you know, in a
not
busy enough
schedule. Not needed, was
it? It's not needed at all. And with Van Persie out, it's a huge blow. Huge blow. I mean, Van Persie just gives them such an edge, such a different angle to that team when he's on the pitch. Fabregas, still question marks about, but he might be back. But if he's struggling with a hamstring problem, I mean, it would be a 75% fit Fabregas at best, probably, if he does play.
And Wenger's got a problem, doesn't he? Because he looks at Fabregas, if there is a doubt, you look at Manchester United coming up in the Cup.
Yeah.
You look at the league race and you say, is it worth sacrificing two other trophies for a Fabregas that might only be 80 or 90% fit going into the Nou Camp?
And could you look at it in the sense that if that is the case, and if Wenger does decide to play Fabregas, Barcelona knock Arsenal out, subsequently Fabregas does his injury even worse, and suddenly Arsenal once again end the season trophyless? I mean, seasons have changed on incidents like that, just small little moments of managers maybe being a little bit too, I suppose, blinded. And perhaps it's ultimately very
given
difficult.
Into temptation, I think,
given
really,
into temptation.
Isn't it?
And, you know, you want your best team on the pitch at every given opportunity. But I think it's very difficult to see Arsenal making their way through to the next stage. Vincenzo Montella making his European debut as Roma's new coach. He's got a tough task ahead of him. They trail 3-2 from the first leg, and now they go to Donetsk for the return game.
Well, you mentioned, we were talking before the show, Donetsk got a great home record in Europe. They've shown this year already they are a team that can score goals at home. They've got some really creative, good, solid attacking players up front. You go through them, Adriano up top, Willem, Jadson, Douglas Costa, they've got some width there. Up against Risa in the first leg. Risa has not had a good season. Cassetti's going to be out. He's suspended. So it's going to be a very, very tough ask of Roma, especially you've got a rookie manager going in. Montella moving up from what was the under 14, under 15 Roma team up into the Champions League round of 16. That is a very big step up. Roma a little bit in disarray in terms of you've got the suspensions. They haven't been on a good run, hence the change in managers. And it's very, very difficult to see how Roma are going to do something that very few teams have ever done before. In fact, only one team has ever done it before, coming back from losing the first leg at home in the Champions League in the knockout stage and managing to go through. So they've got a massive task in front of them, and they're playing against a team that really looks like they've got a pretty good defence as well. They were under a fair bit of pressure against Roma in the first leg. Roma, although they lost 3-2, did have the majority of the play, did have the majority of shots, but Zielinski... is a good player. Didn't work out for him at Barcelona, but he still looks like a pretty good centre-back, and it looks like it's going to be very difficult. Plus, if you're looking at one man that potentially could have the ability or have the potential to change this game round from, you'd look at Totti, but Totti's been in out. The other one would be Menez, and Menez is suspended. So, all in all, you've got to look at Shakhtar being hot favourites to go through.
Heading to Germany next, Schalke hosting Valencia. This game really delicately poised. Schalke have an away goal in the bag from that 1-1 draw in the first game. This one, interesting, a little bit tough to call.
Valencia, I think, after their performance, particularly in the first half against Schalke, would be very disappointed that they're not taking a lead to Germany, because they did play well, they did create some chances. Looked like it wasn't necessarily going to be a one-goal lead. The way they played in the first half, they looked like they were going to have a healthy lead, maybe two, maybe even three. Schalke managed to work their way back in. Raul got the goal. Schalke continued to struggle in the German league. Very much, very mediocre season.
And they had a good result against Munich in the cup.
They did. That maybe gives them some encouragement. Yeah. Of course, Valencia losing to Barcelona in midweek. So, contrasting fortunes. You look at Valencia, I look at Valencia anyway, and I see a lot of talent in the attacking positions and in midfield as well. They've got law options. Joaquin he's beginning to get some more game time. He could be potentially a very important player. I noticed Vicente came back in, came on as substitute in the last game, the game against Schalke, Valencia as well. So they've got potentially a little bit of pace counter-attacking. And I think maybe it's the kind of game that, that if Schalke push forward, Valencia could find a way. Now, I'd said Valencia could be one of the surprise teams, so perhaps I'm trying to justify this to myself, but I still think if Schalke go through, this would be termed a surprise. I would think even at 1-1, I'm still going to still believe that Valencia can find a way of making the last eight. And finally, Spurs went to Milan, 1-0, courtesy of a late Peter Crouch goal. A lot of the performance perhaps overshadowed by Gattuso's and Joe Jordan's incident. But back to White Hart Lane, no Gattuso, suspended. Spurs got to have this one in hand, don't they?
I think so. I was actually talking to people earlier on this week and they were surprised that I thought that Spurs were going to go through. Obviously, Milan have terrific domestic form. There's no doubting that. But I think that Allegri has made his bed and his bed is the Scudetto. And I'm not sure how much he would worry if Milan were knocked out at this junction of the Champions League. Spurs have that away goal in the bag. And I also think that from the way that they played in the San Siro, I think that a draw would have been a great result. They had the added bonus of getting that goal and getting a victory. And I think that they possess huge threats to Milan, the way this Milan team is set up. It's not, Spurs don't play in an Italian way. They've got wingers. They've got pace. It's not narrow. It's not slow building. Obviously, in the San Siro, they had Pienaar wide left with Asuakoto, and it was kind of almost a little bit stifling at times. They were there to serve
two defensive midfield players as well.
Pretty much. Obviously those two defensive midfielders played very, very well in the San Siro. You could look ahead to Tottenham being more attacking at home, which for Milan leads to problems. Obviously they missed that kind of gnarling terrier in the midfield in Gattuso.
Who's playing deeper and deeper as every game goes.
One thing that you would look to Milan for is they have to come out and score.
They have to play Pato, don't they?
They have to play Pato. And they have to try to score early. And now the thing is that the beauty for Spurs is that they pretty much have Milan where they, exactly where they want them. That Milan will come out. There won't be a cagey opening because Milan will have to get in there early on. Even if they do score, one pretty much won't redo the trick. So it'll be kind of a to and fro. I think you can look forward to a fairly attacking game. I'm hoping Milan do score early because it will open the game up. So plenty to play for, but I think Spurs, with that away goal in the bag, should progress to the quarterfinals.
That's all we have time for this week. I'm Bobby McMahon, and on behalf of owner Callahan and producer Luke Crawford, thank you for allowing us to be part of your day. Until the next time, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. For more great soccer news, highlights, and analysis, watch the Fox Soccer Report every night at 10 p.m. Eastern on Fox Soccer and Fox Sports World Canada. And be sure to check out SoccerReportExtra.com daily for previews, opinions, and reviews. Music for this podcast provided by SoundJay.com.